that they were found during a search for them. Three people who were being questioned in the case of the missing men has been arrested and charged. A flight like no other taking off from Edwards Air Force Base in California Friday. An F-16 fighter jet entirely controlled by AI.
No human pilot at all, but riding shotgun, Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall, who says AI has a lot of application in military aviation.
We can put them in places where some of them are intentionally sacrificed in order to draw fire or to find out where the other side is, find out where the enemy is. And I think our pilots in general appreciate that that's going to give them a competitive advantage.
He says the Air Force is planning to roll out an AI-enabled fleet of planes in the coming years. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
And I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
We're going to have policy arguments for the rest of time. But at base, I want my president to be a decent person. I firmly believe that Joe Biden always is trying to do the right thing, that he is a decent man. And in sharp contrast, we've got a man who thinks it's a good thing that stars get to commit sexual assault. And we know that because he said it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local civic media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
Terry Barr, host of Slice of Wisconsin here on Civic Media. Mr. Zommers, what is that called?
My Wife is Drunk by Terry's favorite, Alvin Stasinski.
There you go.
Yeah. It's so funny to listen to a polka because you think, where did that song come from?
Right? We actually had one person text during the break there said, how about the Metal Muffin Polka?
Todd, let's quickly write that and make it.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today we're talking credit scores. I mean, we all know we're supposed to have a good one, but what is a credit score? It's a number rating how likely you are to pay back a loan. Anytime you use credit, you know, like your credit card or a mortgage, the info about what you borrowed and when you paid it gets sent to three credit bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. They track every transaction and compile detailed financial information on every single American. I mean, a little creepy, am I right? And they rate you on a scale from 300 to 850. Over 670 is good, and over 800 is excellent. Then the bureaus sell your rating to anybody who's thinking about lending you money, and you get a better or a worse deal based on your score. Best way to keep that score up is pay your bills on time. This is Carrie Joy from Work Money. For more everyday money tips, check out workmoney.org or text MONEY to 88285. Take good care.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. An AARP study finds one in five Americans 50 and older has nothing saved for retirement. Wisconsin workers are being urged to save now to avoid financial stress later. Mike Mohn reports.
Just affording basic expenses right now is a concern for many, but AARP's Jim Flaherty says you don't want to be caught off guard when retirement nears. He acknowledges it can be hard for younger adults to plan that far ahead when they're juggling expenses like student loan debt, or for older individuals managing costly medications and higher grocery bills.
A lot of times because they're just trying to get by, and they do have to live paycheck to paycheck. But this is one way to say, hey, if you can live with a little bit less from your paycheck every week, that will sure grow.
Researchers note that 57 million Americans don't have access to a retirement plan through their work. Wisconsin has not yet joined the list of states that have created state-operated retirement accounts where employers and their workers can contribute money each pay period. Supporters hope the issue is revisited next legislative session. Flaherty says a combination of individuals being proactive and policymakers easing household budget pressure can hopefully put more people on a path toward a healthy retirement. He says making progress can deter them from looking elsewhere to spend their golden years.
Let's have an infrastructure that makes drugs affordable, that makes healthcare affordable, that makes retirement savings something that's part of their plan, and that'll keep Wisconsinites here.
And groups like AARP have encouraged Congress to address long-term stability concerns for Social Security so that younger workers can anticipate full benefits. Some Republican lawmakers have floated cuts, but senior advocates contend that any solutions to make the program stronger should not be tied to deficit talks. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast for today. Showers are likely. We'll see a high near 62. It'll be breezy out of the southeast. For tonight, partly cloudy, a low around 40. Lots of sunshine for Sunday, highs in the mid-60s. Near 70 with sunshine for Monday. Tuesday, showers and storms. Wednesday, a few showers.
It's 60 at our studios.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
It's producer Amanda. On the next Mino and the Mayor, the guys are joined by Frank Hermans, who has a new show at the Meyer. And the folks from Caribbean Taste Food Truck in Appleton are in our small business spotlight.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly, our weekend venued broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm your host this hour and next hour as well. Our program, our broadcast here on Civic Media is called Amicus, a Law Review. We take our name from our adopted commission here on Civic Media to conduct a review, an analysis, some deliberation, some consideration, some opinion offering as well on the recent news in the areas of law and government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. Amicus, as you know by now, is a legal term. It's derived from the Latin. It is meant to describe a friend, an individual, an organization, an affiliated party of some kind that assists in understanding, providing some appreciation, some assessment of the relevant issues of the day by offering some information or some insight or some perspective or some expertise. And that is indeed our aspiration for this broadcast, for our show here on Civic Media. That's our mission, our goal on this weekly weekend broadcast. That also involves you, and that's a part of our commission as well. You, our listeners, we value you. We cherish your involvement, especially your inquiries, your questions, your pursuit of opinions on this, our broadcast here on Civic Media. This weekend, as always, we invite your calls. Also invite you to contact us again on through the Civic Media app. Phone number is 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, either directly or through the app. Calvin, my wonderful producer here in the studios with me this weekend, is fielding and ushering those calls onto the air. Looking forward to your participation this weekend, as always, in our discussion about those major issues. What is on our syllabus, our academic schedule for this weekend, the next 2 hours on Amicus, a Law Review? We have many issues, and once again, they are pulled from the news stories of just this past week. Let me describe some of those things that we're going to discuss, and again, also invite your comments and questions along the way. We're going to begin, of course, with one of the top, if not the top story in America that also has a rule of law aspect to it, and that is the protests on campuses across our nation. I'm going to talk a little bit about the facts of those, but then spend most of our time doing some civics, as we sometimes do on our weekend broadcast. Yes, we're going to talk about the First Amendment this weekend. We're going to talk about what the First Amendment says, provide you with a little bit of law school stuff on how it's been interpreted over the years, interpreted even to this day. When it comes to the application of the First Amendment, I will affirm again, as I always do on this and other broadcasts of Civic Media, that there is no right. There is no right in our Constitution, even statutory rights, that is completely unconditional. There are restrictions and limitations on all of those things, even as we affirm the fundamental notions in our Bill of Rights and in other aspects of our Constitution. the First Amendment. The First Amendment is no exception to that. We'll talk about the language of the First Amendment and then talk about the ways in which the courts have interpreted its application. Why? To ensure that the First Amendment guarantees the right to speech and assembly and advocacy and all of those other things that we hold dear in this country, but also does so in the midst of a society, a larger group of people we work with and we live with, and we have our livelihood with other people. And for that reason, First Amendment rights are also in some ways limited. We'll talk about the language of those limitations, even as we affirm the fundamental concepts there as well, so that we can get some sense of how we make sense of what is going on the campuses today. The difficult issues being confronted, yes, by students, yes, by faculty, also by law enforcement, and also by university and college administration dealing with these issues. How do you balance the right to First Amendment speech and advocacy and assembly with the interests of safety and security? We will talk all about that and give you some sense, give you some ability, if you will, to apply the basic legal standards to what you're hearing about in America today, even as we go forward in the coming weeks as the protests and other advocacies continue in America. Necessarily, we're going to spend some time talking about, as we have in recent weeks, the trial of Donald Trump, which continues in a Manhattan courtroom in front of Judge Juan Merchan. This is the criminal trial alleging violations of New York law, financial reporting violations when it comes to invoices and checks and registry documents that arguably, allegedly, were committed by Donald Trump, with the support and playing the involvement of others. And we're going to talk about some of those others who have testified just this past week. It has indeed been a significant week in the trial of that case, including just this past Friday, the testimony of Hope Hicks, one of Donald Trump's senior advisors, his communications director when he was the president of the United States of America. We're going to talk, as we all do, always do, about credibility, how juries make assessments of witnesses on the stand. What kinds of things do they look to? Try to figure out, determine whether or not this person is credible or not, believable or not. Are they supporting a larger narrative as a part of the trial? Are they arguing? Are they articulating some positions contrary to that narrative, which suggests that the overall positions being articulated by the parties are not true or are not subject to belief? We'll chat about some of the recent testimony, not just involving Hope Hicks, but other witnesses who populated the witness stand in that Manhattan courtroom just this past week. And then we'll look a little bit to the future, anticipating the continuation of that trial, which is, in the end, as we have described, also a trial about election interference, which again continues to be the principal statement, the principal position articulated by the district attorney in that case. Necessarily, as we begin to look forward to that time when the United States Supreme Court is going to be issuing some major decisions, we're going to do a little bit of revisiting a discussion that we had in our last weekend's program. That is about this major argument, the argument involving Trump versus United States. That's the name of the case. It is executive immunity, presidential immunity. We spent a lot of time in our program last week talking about the merits and, from my view, the demerits of the argument that was pursued, conducted by the justices. A couple more perspectives on that coming out from the constitutional premise of what is an official act today. We're going to talk about that as well and give you some additional opportunity, as always, to call in and ask questions of me, inquiries of yours about what we can expect and what we might anticipate from our Supreme Court as they continue to deliberate on these cases, 62 cases altogether on their docket, as you well know, 18 already decided, leaving a good number for decision, yes, indeed, between now and mid-June, which is not too long. That's about 6 weeks or so. They could go a little bit longer, but highly unlikely. So we're going to chat, as we're going to be doing this weekend's broadcast and in future broadcasts, about what we're going to anticipate in the coming weeks among those many, many cases. What are the big ticket items that are out there? What should we anticipate? And that is, yes, that's also a teaser for Amicus Law Review, because as those decisions begin to get issued in the weeks just ahead here in the United States of America, we're going to be spending some time talking about precisely what the Supreme Court has done, the majority of the Supreme Court has done in those many cases, and what the minority, what the dissenters have said in those cases, to give you some in-depth sense, some microscopic justice analysis, if you will, about what our high court is doing on your behalf, on my behalf, in interpreting and applying the law of our nation. This past week has also been a big week in connection with another of those major issues that has been on the docket of the Supreme Court in the past and remains on the docket this term as well. We'll talk again about an abortion case that the Supreme Court recently entertained, again, an oral argument in its courtroom there in Washington, D.C. We're going to go back and talk about the impact of the Dobbs decision, June of 2022, this major decision issued by a majority, not a unanimous verdict by the Supreme Court, not a unanimous judgment by the Supreme Court, but a majority telling us that under the Constitution, a privacy right to reproductive rights and reproductive access to abortion no longer exists, if ever it did. Justice Sam Alito telling us that Roe versus Wade was not only wrong now, but wrong when it was decided back in 1973, issued by Harry Blackmun and others at that time. I'm going to go back and talk about the consequences of that Dobbs decision in places like Arizona and Florida, both of which have wrestled with the abortion issue in their highest courts, in their state Supreme Courts, and then have also undertaken other actions. In one situation, a legislative action of just this past week, an executive action signed by the governor in one of those states. In another one of them, a major referendum, a decision to be decided by the people of Florida with respect to their constitution, whether the Constitution of Florida will or will not enshrine in its very terms some abortion rights. We're going to talk about what happens in Arizona and Florida, not just this past week, but going forward as well. Time permitting. And it is always tight because we have so many things to discuss. We'll also chat about another major matter going on, which we have not discussed on our weekend broadcast here on Amicus Law Review, and that is this major civil litigation brought by the United States Department of Justice, the Antitrust Division, against Google, a several-week trial in the courts of America. And we'll talk about the allegations in that civil case. This is not a criminal matter, but it is a federal case. And we'll talk about the allegations, the defenses made by Google to anti-competitive arguments made about its conduct with respect to it and competition in the area of social media. We'll chat about that. Why? Because oral arguments, closing arguments, just concluding just this past week, anticipating that a federal district court judge named Judge Mehta, we've talked about him before in context of some of the major decisions coming out of the January 6th rioters, the insurrectionists. We're going to talk about what Judge Mehta has before him in that Google case and why it is important, not only for the rule of law and justice and government, but also for all of us who think about the future of social media in our nation. All of that coming up in the next 2 hours on this, our weekend broadcast here on Civic Media. This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I invite your continued involvement in our discussion this weekend, as always.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
If you hear a siren, it could be a response for help after a fall. Oshkosh Fire Chief Mike Stanley says it's the number one reason for calls to his department.
Much more significantly than we respond to fires, to heart attacks, car accidents, traumatic injuries. We're going on fall calls more often than not.
Stanley hopes a new partnership with the company behind a free balance training app, Nimble, N-Y-M-B-L, can help seniors avoid falls by improving balance with exercises from the app.
I can do this from my home. I can do this from my living room so that I don't have to worry about securing a ride to go somewhere.
Look for more information going out with water bills across Oshkosh this month. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
This is Amicus Lauraview, and my name is Jim Santel. Thank you for once again joining me this weekend for our discussion of the aspiration for justice in America, some government issues, some legal issues as well, and we jump right into those in this, the second segment of our first hour on our weekend broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media, inviting you as always to call in, to engage with Calvin and me at 844-967-2789, either directly or through the Civic Media app. Looking forward to your comments, your questions, especially your questions and inquiries. Let's begin in our first syllabus item this morning. We all know well what is going on at many universities, many colleges across the United States of America. We have protest encampments. We have protests of various kinds focused upon the war in the Middle East, Gaza and Israel. Many of the student protests, the encampments, the other activities, which we will talk about, focusing upon requests, petitions for those universities and colleges to divest, to engage in divestment when it comes to companies that may be supporting the war effort with respect to Israel, the IDF against Hamas, and the war going on in the Middle East, in Gaza generally. Some of that focus simply upon the government's position, our State Department, our executive position on the war in Gaza. All of that, as you know well, as you have digested the news, focusing our campus, a lot of our campus attention upon the Middle East, things beyond our borders. And you know as well that there have been differences in the ways in which these protests have proceeded. Some of them have been completely quiet. And by that, I do not mean ineffective necessarily, but they have not been violent. They have been situations where there is advocacy, some of it strong, some of it aggressive, but not in any ways violent. Other cases, in other instances, at the other extreme, we look to places like Columbia and UCLA, where yes, indeed, there was violence involving a takeover of buildings. In the case of Columbia, Hamilton Hall, that iconic building there on the University of there at Columbia, UCLA, just Thursday morning, finally, a bloody encounter between protesters and other protesters, counter-protesters, brought to an end by the involvement of the police there at UCLA, as it was in Columbia, and all sorts of differences in between as this has spread across and populated our campuses, including places like Brown and Rutgers and even Northwestern, not too far from us here in Wisconsin, where the university engaged in discussions with members of the protesting groups, the students and others as well, and has indeed achieved some peace, perhaps an imperfect peace, but some agreements about how indeed we can all live together on those campuses without the violence. And those have involved some negotiations, some agreements about future discussions in many of those campuses, including Northwestern, where university officials and some of the pro-Palestinian demonstrators struck a deal, if you will, that brought an end to the protest encampment on that campus and involves some future disclosures of information, some future discussions in the fall about divestment. And that, of course, even that kind of resolution is not without its controversy. More advocacy under the First Amendment. It has drawn some criticism from some of the Jewish leaders, some of the Jewish students there. And that, of course, all of that is what America is all about, the capacity to disagree and to engage in discussion. And that is indeed what leads us to our civics aspect this morning about what the First Amendment says, what it doesn't say, what we can take away, admittedly, in a fairly superficial way this morning. This is not going to be a law school class. When you go to law school, when you've had other classes, the professors, the legal scholars will spend weeks, if not months, talking about the implications of the First Amendment because there is a lot out there. There's a lot of good case law. There's a lot of controversial case law out there about the application of the First Amendment. We're going to do sort of a general analysis of what the standards are when it comes to things like restrictions on the First Amendment and areas where government should not become involved, to give you some sense, perhaps some mechanisms for applying those standards to what you're seeing right now. I will let you all do that on your own, because these things also involve a certain amount of subjective assessment. Some of it subjective, much of it subjective. But we'll talk about the First Amendment, which, of course, says the Congress. That's how it begins. Although that has been interpreted, as you also well know, to mean the government. The government shall make no law. And there are also expressions, of course, in the First Amendment about religious liberty, the requirement that government not become involved in the establishment of religion. But the focus this weekend is on this language in the First Amendment that says, the government shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people to freely assemble. That's what James Madison wrote. That's what our Constitution says. The first Congress passed that, of course, as you know, as a part of the Bill of Rights, and that remains a key part of our Constitution. Those are some of the first words in our Bill of Rights. And so how have the courts interpreted that? What kinds of things can government do and not do when it comes to applying that very broad language, that very inspirational language, aspiration for justice? How do courts interpret all of that in understanding what the First Amendment means and what it does not mean? Let's begin by talking about some restrictions that indeed the courts across time have permitted governments, and that includes local institutions and state institutions and federal institutions, to apply. They're called time, place, and manner restrictions. Time, place, and manner. And those are also referred to as content-neutral restrictions. We'll get to all of that. Time, place, and manner restrictions. This goes to my fundamental proposition, my fundamental notion that there's no such thing as a right in the Constitution, including the First Amendment, that is unconditional. All of those rights, including the First Amendment, have some restrictions because we live in communities, because we live in a society of people, and we need to balance those individual rights to free speech and advocacy and assembly, and yes, of the press as well, with a concern about our overall safety and security and well-being. And so, the courts have said that governments can, in fact, impose restrictions on the timing, when it is you actually advocate in the public domain for changes, do other things in the advocacy pool, the places where you can do that advocacy. Yes, indeed, government can limit your access to certain areas. They can ask you, they can require you to submit permits for permission to occupy certain areas. And yes, indeed, they can also restrict to some extent the manner in which you even go about communicating. The issue may be noise. The issue may be the kinds of signs and posters that you may use. All of that, a balancing test in content-neutral restrictions that the Supreme Court and other courts have said the governments can indeed impose. Content-neutral meaning just that. We're not imposing restrictions based upon the content, the substance of what you say. Those have got to be content-neutral, but governments can indeed tell you when and when you cannot engage in advocacy in the public domain. You can, as a part of a government official action, engage in limitations on place and also on, again, the manner, the very manner in which those content-neutral messages are conveyed. All of that can be done. Even so, under many cases, the word is, the law is, the limitations have to be narrowly tailored to serve a significant government interest. They've got to be focused upon exactly what the government wants to do, and they have to leave some alternative ways of communicating messages. As we continue here on Amicus Law Review, more about the standards for the First Amendment, including some understandings of access to our campuses and beyond.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Talks today in Cairo aimed at reaching a possible truce in Gaza.
U.S. officials saying if there is a deal now, the aim will be to build on a temporary ceasefire and work on broader agreements that could bring lasting peace to this region. There's a lot at stake as we wait for that official Hamas response to the proposed deal.
ABC's Tom Sophie Borridge in Tel Aviv. Heavy rain, swollen rivers, and today the Houston area bracing for more flooding. People in low-lying areas being told to evacuate ahead of an expected catastrophic surge of water. Texas Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife Imelda indicted. The Department of Justice alleging the couple accepted $600,000 in bribes, charges that could land them in prison for decades if they're convicted. A deadly outbreak of tuberculosis in Long Beach, California that's now killed one person, the city declaring a public health emergency. A lower-than-expected jobs report rekindled hopes on Wall Street that an interest rate cut could be coming. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
What's next for Doc Rivers? Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks season came to an end Thursday night with a loss to the Pacers. Doc Rivers, who played basketball at Marquette, was asked what's it been like returning to Milwaukee nearly 40 years later.
I love it. I have an amazing appreciation for the city I live in, Milwaukee now. You know, it's funny, I was there in college, and I thought a lot about it. Didn't realize how much it would mean to me, honestly, until I got the job. And then I started thinking about all the guys, Hank Raymonds and Rick Majerus and all the professors at Marquette. I probably wouldn't be here if I hadn't have gone to that school. So a lot of ways I feel like I'm going to do whatever I can for this franchise. And I really am. I think we can win. I'm going to do everything I can to create that because it means more to me than I think you think for all those reasons. So it's rare. Usually right after the year, you want to go take a break. I can't wait to get started.
That's the Bucks head coach, Doc Rivers. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast for today. Showers are likely. We'll see a high near 62. It'll be breezy out of the southeast. For tonight, partly cloudy, a low around 40. Lots of sunshine for Sunday, highs in the mid-60s. Near 70 with sunshine for Monday. Tuesday, showers and storms. Wednesday, a few showers.
Right now, it's 62.
The Todd Alba Show.
State Senator Kelda Royce in Richland County. The UW system made the unilateral decision to completely vacate the campus by July 1st of this year.
It's so short-sighted to think it costs a little bit more money to run it and there aren't as many students, so let's just shut it down. A smart business owner would say now is the time to invest because we know every person that comes through the door, you're going to get 40-fold the investment from how they're going to be able to give back to our state.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Earl Ingram.
In Wisconsin, parents pay one-third of their income on child care. Think about what we need our income for. Shelter, food, clothing, gas bill, electric bill. And we're talking about one child. This is a crisis. Young families are saddled with what is almost impossible to deal with.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to retired Major General Randy Manner about Project 2025 and what that could mean to American democracy. Hour number two, cars versus deer. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for our weekend program here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We are beginning our weekend broadcast this weekend, along with Kelvin. We're taking your phone calls, your comments to the Civic Media app at 844-967-2789, beginning our discussion this weekend with the campus protests and providing some civic instruction, if you will, a little bit of a mini law school this weekend on what the First Amendment means and what the courts have done when it comes to interpreting what you can and cannot do under the First Amendment. We were chatting right before the recent break about all these time, place, and manner restrictions that can indeed be imposed upon a group of people or an individual seeking to petition government, seeking to advocate in the public domain about various issues. Those kinds of things, time, place, and manner restrictions permitted under the First Amendment. Government can indeed limit those things in a content-neutral way. You cannot prohibit expressions under the First Amendment in terms of subject matter. I cannot establish as an alderman, as a legislator, as a federal official, limitations on subject matter. So, for example, if I wanted to advocate about issues in the area of labor or abortion or environment or immigration or, yes, indeed, the war in Gaza, the courts have looked at limitations on subject matter with a high, high deal of skepticism and even high scrutiny, basically prohibiting those kinds of things. That's where the First Amendment really takes its hold. What you cannot do, of course, is push back on reasonable limitations related to time, place, and manner. You can negotiate with local officials about the circumstances, and that is also contemplated by many of the decisions that the Supreme Court and others have issued. That is this notion that while there are rules and standards, much of it has to do with the circumstances, the physical layout, the particular facts of a case, and the situation that prompts the advocacy in the public domain. A restriction could also run afoul of the content neutral touchstone, the standard, if you will, if those circumstances surrounding the enactment, the passage, the placement of the time, place, or manner restriction somehow reveals a government intent to favor or punish some particular messages. In other words, even if it doesn't come right out and say you can't talk about the environment, you can't talk about abortion or about immigration or about the economy, even if it doesn't come out and say that, if there's something about the mechanism by which the restriction was applied and enforced, something maybe in its legislative history that suggests that there really is another animus, another reason for going ahead and imposing some restrictions, it may well be that government is violating the content neutral notion when it comes to passing all of that kind of restriction. All of this to say that there are rules, and yes, they are applied, as the Supreme Court has said, according to the specific circumstances. Some of those circumstances relate, of course, to whether or not the venue, as with colleges and campuses, whether they're private or public. The First Amendment applies very broadly and very expansively to public institutions, public places, private institutions, private locations, including colleges and universities. No. However, most of our colleges and universities across our nation, whether they are certainly public but private as well, have adopted these fundamental notions about the First Amendment permitting on campuses the fundamental expressions of the First Amendment, the invocations of it, so that the lines, if you will, when it comes to public and private institutions, not blurred, but nonetheless, the rules, for the most part, do apply across the board, even though in the private institutions, they are not enforceable, if you will, under the Constitution itself, probably in a court of law. Most universities have adopted them even so. All universities, public, private, public places, private places that are not places of academic education, have also embraced and understand what the courts have also told us about violence. And that is just basically this, that the First Amendment advocates for and promotes and encourages, once again, freedom of the press and freedom of speech and freedom of the people to freely assemble. What the Supreme Court has said the First Amendment does not do is permit violence. It does not permit violence against other people. It does not permit destruction of property, all those kinds of things that would move beyond the protections of the First Amendment, whether we talk about content neutral distinctions or other things under the standards, the touchstones there. Violence is not protected by the First Amendment, nor are affirmative calls to violence. Affirmative calls to violence, invocations to go and commit violent acts, property, people, all those kinds of things. That is an area of expression, and it is expression, that is not protected by the First Amendment. Indeed, there's an entire catalog, if you will, of jurisprudence out there that talks about fighting words and about the kinds of things that are said in the public domain that if indeed they incite violence, and that again, that can be a determination made by a jury, a judge, made by government, made by people on the scene. If you are, in fact, inciting violence of some kind, destruction of some kind, that is not protected by the First Amendment. And so all of those standards being used right now, no doubt the lawyers are spending lots of time these days with government officials and also with administrators on the campuses of our public and our private institutions across the country, including right here in Wisconsin, determining where the line is, making informed judgments based upon what the law is, and then also applying what the courts have also encouraged, which is the exercise of discretion. The campuses and other places of education, of common company, if you will, of gathering, often say that indeed, while it is possible to prohibit certain kinds of protests, the reality is that in the interest of promoting the First Amendment, we may permit some things to happen that may not be within the four corners of the First Amendment itself. And so, for example, an encampment that is not the subject or is not permitted by virtue of a permit, whether it's in a public park, on a campus, some other place, some movement up and down a sidewalk in a street without authorization by a local government, the time, place, and manner restrictions that we talked about, government will often look at that and say, we will permit you to do that even though we might be able to enforce some restrictions against you. Why? Because we want to embrace in America, in our town, in our state, in our city, the basic tenets, the basic operations, the practices of the First Amendment. And so that is often done, and it is endorsed. It is endorsed by the courts. And we have seen a lot of that also on campuses as well recently, where administrators and others will say, although this particular encampment, this particular activity, this particular marching may not be the subject of authorization, we will let it go forward because it's not violent. It's not crossing that line. There's no incitement to violence. And we encourage the discussion, especially on campuses, where we have discussed before on this broadcast, the all-important notion of education, of sharing views that are different from our own, of hearing from others and sometimes hearing offensive language, that is also contemplated and protected by our First Amendment. Things we don't want to hear, that's what America is about. That is especially what campuses are all about, private and public as well. The courts have encouraged administrators and government officials to find that line, based upon the circumstances, should be animated by the definition of that line, should be animated by the circumstances. And that ensures both an adherence to what the First Amendment is all about, but also establishes that there are lines, and those lines can be crossed. And when, as on the campus of UCLA, there is bloodshed, when protesters and anti-protesters, other protesters engage in fight and people are getting hurt, that is crossing the line. And that is when, yes, administrators, as they did at the campus of UCLA very early Thursday morning, this past Thursday morning, called in the police to bring this to a close. That's when you cross that line. At Columbia, also in Hamilton Hall, at some point, the administration said the destruction of property there, the smashing of windows, the destruction of other hallways and furniture, those kinds of things, that cannot be tolerated. That is not protected. And now we have to make the decision to call in the police, the law enforcement authorities, to bring that to an end because it has gone too far. But all of that analysis based upon not a moving standard, but a standard that's premised upon what is happening now in the moment, we anticipate that our administrators and especially our law enforcement have in front of them not only these basic standards about time, place, and manner, restrictions that can be made, but also the notion that content-neutral approaches have got to be a part of any establishment of rules and regulations, and the notion, once again, the First Amendment is not unconditional. There are times when expressions and advocacies go beyond the protections of the Constitution, and that includes especially violence against people, against places, against property, and that is when the protections of our Constitution of the Bill of Rights no longer attach. All of that presented and offered to you, not in explanation or in justification or in reasonable analysis of every single thing that has happened in America on the campuses of our universities and colleges, but to give you some sense about the decision-making process that goes along in determining where the First Amendment adheres, where it does not. And decisions made, by the way, not only by administrators, but yes, by law enforcement, and yes, indeed, the students themselves and others who may advocate for change, for things that they feel strongly about in all of those areas that are content-specific and do have substantive content to them. All of that offered to you this weekend on our broadcast as we think about the First Amendment generally and the First Amendment protections that are guaranteed to us, not without conditions. As always, we appreciate your phone calls, your comments as they come into our weekend broadcast. And right now we've got Bill calling in from Oconomowoc. Bill, appreciate your comment, your question, your inquiry to me this morning about the subject matter of our broadcast. Bill, are you with us this morning?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Bill, I do hear you.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we do hear you loud and clearly, Bill. Yes, go ahead.
Do you remember when you and I revisited what you're talking about now about a couple months ago, and I asked you ethics charges on a number of lawyers and maybe judges could be about to happen? Do you remember that discussion we had?
Well, I remember you calling in, and we had a discussion about many things. Yes, but go ahead, Bill. What's your comment or question this morning?
Well, here's my point. You would know more than anybody. Are we getting close to that point where ethics and judges' ethics and a lot of these attorneys that are linked with Trump are about to be questioned themselves?
And the I'm going to take this in a slightly different aspect and answer your question by saying that the reality is that lawyers are already being taken in that direction, right? We know about people like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and especially John Eastman recently, subject of review of their ethical predicates, if you will, their status right now. Their bar licenses are being examined. And that applies to me, to every other practicing lawyer out there. We are indeed, Bill, as you've affirmed again on this weekend broadcast, we are always, as lawyers, held to standards. We talk about being the officers of the court. And even just this past week, in the subject matter we're going to take up very shortly here, the trial in Manhattan, the judge talking about the obligations of lawyers appearing in front of him as officers of court to follow ethics rules and principles. That is always the case, frankly, whether you're in court or out of court. Bill, appreciate the comment, appreciate the call as well. And we also have Mark calling in from Prairie du Sac. Mark, your question or your inquiry this morning.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. This is kind of going beyond, a little beyond what's going on right now. But under the expansive nature that the Supreme Court appears to be looking at to expand presidential powers, finding some secret wording in the Constitution that gives the executive, you know, the power to off his political opponents.
And absolutely, and right, and Mark, appreciate the comment. I'm going to maybe have you stay on hold here. We're going to chat about the Supreme Court in a later segment here on our weekend broadcast, talking all about what the Supreme Court is doing and not doing as we continue our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Most of us agree that every Wisconsinite deserves affordable health care. California mega millionaire Eric Hovde does not. Hovde said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, quote, in its entirety. What? The Affordable Care Act protects people from insurance companies refusing coverage for pre-existing conditions and stops them from dropping your coverage if you get sick. If Eric Hovde got his way, millions of Americans could get hit with increases in their healthcare premiums of 20% or more. Millions more could lose coverage altogether. Hovde even spoke out against parents helping their kids by keeping them on their health insurance plans until they turn 26. Now, that might be okay for Eric Hovde. His businesses have raked in millions of dollars in handouts. But it doesn't cut it for hardworking Wisconsinites and our families. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him we support lower health care costs. Paid for by Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, we're talking about lawyers. We're talking about courts. Mark asking some good questions, making some good points about our Supreme Court and the ways in which they decide cases. Going to take up that encouragement, that invitation by Mark, and talk now about the Supreme Court and revisiting something that we talked about just last week, and that is this major oral argument in this case involving Trump versus United States, United States versus Trump. This is the immunity argument. And we spent a lot of time in our broadcast last weekend talking about the oral argument itself, offering some views about what is going on here with our United States Supreme Court, just as Mark was beginning to chat about some of the issues that he also identifies among our judiciary, commenting last week about the turning of this issue into something substantively important when, in fact, it is not. The notion that a president, our chief executive, under the Constitution, under the laws, 240 years of laws, would be immune from criminal prosecution under some regimen to be decided by the Supreme Court. All of that I have offered up, and as have many others, as an example of the Supreme Court arguably going down a path they do not need to go down and getting it wrong when it comes to trying to parse out what are official and personal acts, what are official things done by a president and those things done in a personal capacity. This weekend, approaching it from a slightly different perspective, and that is a statement made by Richard Nixon way back in context of his interviews with David Frost. Some of you may remember that as well. Nixon said at the time, well, when the president does it, it means that it's not illegal. And Frost said, by definition, he said, exactly. If the president, for example, approves something because of the national security, then the president's decision in that instance is one that enables those who carry it out to carry it out without violating a law. And while that language from Richard Nixon may strike many of us, including me, as being inappropriate and even offensive under the Constitution, he's onto a bit of something that the Supreme Court about 10 days or so ago could have understood better. And that is what makes the questions about things going on inside official capacity exercises so difficult. It's the same thing, exactly the same thing that makes Trump versus the United States so very easy. Richard Nixon was speaking about cases where the president is clearly executing a core presidential power. He's talking about something in the national security area. But that left, of course, obscure in the oral argument in Trump versus the United States. The thing that was left obscure that is that Donald Trump is not, according to the allegations in the indictment against him, was not executing some presidential power in any legally relevant sense. When he did what? When he engaged in the behaviors charged in that grand jury indictment. None of the hard questions of presidential immunity are raised by that case, which is what we have said and advocated for on this broadcast and others. The only hard question is, why did the members of the Supreme Court permit this to sound a whole lot more complicated? Why did the lawyers, at least for Donald Trump, go down this road of suggesting that this is a difficult case when in fact it is not? What is absolutely clear about our Constitution and our constitutional tradition, of course, is that the president has no official authority or duty when it comes to selecting the next president, not in his or her official capacity. It's a question even whether Congress itself has anything to do with the selection of the president beyond what we know is the counting of electoral votes. Instead, where does that power inhere? It's the states. It is the states, right, that have the primary and perhaps exclusive power to determine the elements necessary for choosing the president of the United States of America. And we know that by virtue of what we've seen and our own constitutional access. The state legislatures are given the exclusive power to appoint in such manner as they may direct presidential electors. That's in the Constitution. In 2020, the court held that the power to tell presidential electors how they vote and that how they must vote, that was also the subject, again, of analysis and affirmation by our courts. The point of all of this is that the president can, in fact, play a role in this process, but it's not official. The president does not have an official authorized role to play in a free country. All of us free to lobby a legislature, to reach out to a secretary of state, to reach out to other elected officials. But it doesn't mean that when a president does try to play a role in that process, he or maybe one day she is doing that in anything other than a private capacity, in a personal capacity as a citizen, a candidate, not a president who's performing the duties of his office. Or more directly, he or she is not executing an official act. And that's what the Supreme Court, from another perspective, failed to understand when it pursued all of this. Donald Trump, according to the allegations in the complaint, again, the indictment here, assumed innocent until proven guilty, not exercising any power to police presidential elections given to him by the Congress when he engaged in the acts charged in that grand jury indictment. Again, because neither the Congress nor the president has any constitutional power to police how the states carry out their obligation to participate in a presidential election. The actions, as alleged, were therefore not official acts because the authority to perform those acts flowed not from the Constitution nor from any federal law. The president acting not with any shield of federal law, but merely as an ordinary citizen. That's the personal part of it. That's the point of Michael Dreeben responding to the Supreme Court justices who are suggesting that somehow, according to the allegations in this indictment, there is this distinction between personal and official, when in fact there is not. There is not. This is an ordinary citizen trying to bring about the political result that he wanted, all personal in nature. And for that reason, once again, we come back to the fundamental assessment of what happened in front of our Supreme Court last week and determine with some certainty that the Supreme Court right now is wrestling with this strange and peculiar bifurcation between official and personal actions of Donald Trump, as alleged, when in fact there is nothing of the sort that is official. Amy Coney Barrett said, well, gee, can't you go back and parse out the personal stuff from the official stuff? Michael Dreeben appropriately saying, no, you cannot do that. As I have said previously on this broadcast, I am still hopeful that the Supreme Court goes back and during the course of the deliberation undertaken right now, as it begins to assemble this all-important decision about presidential immunity, comes back to its senses and says, no, indeed, there is no such thing that protects a president in the performance of his duties that is criminal in nature, protects from prosecution. We anticipate the Supreme Court, hopefully, will come to that conclusion, but we'll report on that in the weeks ahead here on our weekend broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome author of Searching for Patty Hearst, a true crime novel, Roger Rappaport, and Wisconsin comedian Tracy Schrader joins me in studio.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Tom has been a teacher for over 40 years. One day, I think one of the students had asked the question and he didn't remember the answer. And I also noticed that he was letting his class out earlier than they were supposed to let out. I was really starting to worry.
Levi and I talked about how it would change our lives, but he was there beside me.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.